All right, welcome to part two of 2,000 Years of the Jewish Odyssey, the second century of the Common Era. We're sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ila Nishmas, Yonah ben Rabbi Aryeh Leib, Tzeinit Nishmas of Tshuva Tzara Chaim, and we thank them for their sponsorship. As the second century dawned, the situation of the Jews was perilous, especially in the land of Israel. The national center had been destroyed. Jews had been exiled by the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, and attacked in their domiciles abroad as well. The Torah world, after the Churban, had begun to recover in Yavne, again, only to be forced underground again as well. And yet many people lived in anticipation that this Churban, like the first Churban, would be reversed. How? That, of course, is another story we'll discuss. But they thought that just like the first Churban had been undone after 70 years, so too this as well. The reign of Trajan unleashed a new wave of persecution. So at the turn of the century, the national condition was deteriorating. In our terms, it was the year 3860. So Trajan succeeded Nerva, who had been the rare benevolent emperor of Rome. He was actually kindly disposed to Jews, even revoking the special tax that Roman emperors had decades earlier imposed on Jews. So whereas just 25 years before Nerva, the Romans had minted coins that were inscribed Judea Capta, Judea is captured. Nerva minted coins that read Fisci Iudaici Calumnia Sublata, which means, oh, you all know, the disgrace of the Jew tax has been removed. See, he went public with the fact that he was fond of Jews and supportive of our attainments. Many Romans apparently felt that Nerva had a lot of Nerva, so his reign was short-lived. He died in the year 98 after ruling for only 2 years, and when Trajan took power in 98, he immediately restored the harsh measures that were traditional to Rome and even intensified them. Now, Trajan had one dream, and not for the last time, Jews would become pawns in the struggles, the geopolitical struggles of empires. In brief, no Roman had ever captured Persia, and no person since Alexander the Great had ruled the entire world. Trajan wanted that reputation, those conquests, and he wanted especially to conquer the nations to the east, and he devoted all of his efforts to that purpose. The conquest of Parthia. Parthia controlled a swath of territory running from Asia Minor, Turkey, Armenia, that area, in an arc, all the way to Pakistan. Now, this territory included Babel, where Jews had lived in safety and with a good deal of autonomy for 500 years. So, in fact, in that sense, the Babylonian Jews were not affected by the Churban or the Roman persecutions in Israel because they were subjects of a different sovereign. They were under the reign of the Parthians. So Trajan went to war against the Parthians, and he felt that the Jews were a fifth column, both in Israel and across the Roman Empire. Remember that Jews were situated in very sensitive areas in all the major cities. We were commercial leaders then as now. And Israel itself was at a crossroads between the continents then as now. So Trajan immediately sought to diminish any sense of Jewish identity and Jewish nationhood. In the 80s, Agrippa II, who was Herod's great-grandson, had been given a zone of autonomy in the Galilee. That was taken away, and he was deposed. Trajan disbanded Yavne for a second time, and again the Sanhedrin went underground. Ram Gamliel de Yavne, the Nasi, went into hiding in Lod, and he eventually died in just a few years into the second century. I digress for a moment. The Gemara says in Ksuvas Avchafam Echesam et Beis that Rabbi Gamliel is well remembered and extolled until today for a number of things, but especially this. It was a custom of the time that people who could would spend exorbitant sums of money on funerals, such that the poor had taken just to leaving the bodies in the street rather than give a funeral that they felt was beneath the dignity of the deceased, to leave the body there anonymously and let the Chevra Kadisha bury the person. Ad Rabbi Gamliel nohag kalus v'atzmo, until Rabbi Gamliel directed that he be treated with simple dignity, and he directed that he be buried in tachrichin, in simple white linen shrouds. That was around the year 105-107, and that became the custom of Jews ad hayom. We're buried in tachrichin, just like Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel was nominally succeeded by his son, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, but he too went into hiding. And it was considered prudent, in any event, that authority not be wielded by anyone who was a descendant of David. In the house of the Nasi, the house of Hillel, were all descendants of David HaMelech. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah remained the de facto Nasi. He relocated to Tzipori in the Galil, away from the center of the action. And the Gemara refers to this period of time very cryptically on a number of occasions. The Tosefta writes that once a number of Tanaim went to visit Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah Cheresh Tzipori, when he was in hiding in Tzipori. Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, they went into hiding in Lod, teaching in what the Gemara calls Aliyas Beis Nitza Bilod, in the attic of the house of Nitza in the city of Lod. Lod, of course, exists until today. In Nitza's attic. And there they discussed weighty issues, which were signs of the times. The Gemara says on a number of occasions, Nimnu v'gomru aliyas beis nitza belod. They debated, they deliberated such and such in the attic of the house of Nitza in Lod. So for example, the Gemara Sanhedrin daf ayin dalet amud aleph, Nimnu v'gomru, they debated, they deliberated that a person who is forced to violate any mitzvah in the Torah, Yavar v'al yehareg, he should violate that mitzvah rather than allow himself to be killed, except for the three cardinal sins, Gilai Roya, Shrichas Samim, and Avodah Zarah, except for sexual immorality and idolatry and homicide. In other words, in Aliyas Beis Nitzah Bilod, in the first decade of the second century, they determined the laws of Kiddush Hashem, what were the parameters which a person had to give up his life. Or the Gemara Kiddush Daf Mem Amud Beis, Nimnu V'Gomru Aliyas Beis Nitzah Bilod. They deliberated as well. Talmud Gadol or Maisa Gadol, which is greater, the learning, the study of Torah, or the practice of Torah? And it was a good discussion. We think of it as a theoretical discussion. They sat around smoking cigars, philosophizing. No, here Judaism is forced underground. And they had to decide which area of Torah, which area of Jewish life would be their focus. Was it the study of Torah, or was it the Maaseh HaMitzvos? So Nimnu V'Gomru, they decided Talmud Gadol, Shemevi Lidei Masa. The study of Torah is more important, because without the study of Torah, the mitzvos themselves will enervate and eventually disappear. So these were discussions. It's not the typical Vada Rabbanan meeting that you have today. These are real weighty issues that shape the way we look at the world until today. Back to the war, so Trajan very systematically weakened any resistance possible against his armies, and he planned his war assiduously, and he launched his attack finally in the year 114. The Parthians fought vigorously, but they steadily lost, overwhelmed by the Romans in Armenia, in northern Iraq, and then finally Trajan conquered not all of Parthia, but all the land up to and including the Persian Gulf area. But the war was not over. Trajan had succeeded in finding a beachhead, so to speak, on the Persian Gulf, and the Parthians responded with guerrilla warfare. Does that sound familiar? Attacking Roman troops behind the lines. So they were most effective, because when Trajan advanced southward, and think again, we're in ancient times, We're not in modern times. In ancient times, he advanced so quickly to the Persian Gulf that he cut himself off from his supply lines and his reinforcements. So he assumed the Parthians, once subjugated, would remain subjugated. He was dead wrong. The Parthians attacked the Roman, the rear guard of the Roman armies, and inflicted heavy casualties. Interestingly enough, in this the Parthians were assisted by the Jews of Babel, who took up arms against the Romans. After all, the Romans had destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. So now Jews went to war against Rome in Babel and inflicted casualties on them as well. The Parthians, and history does repeat itself, refused to surrender, and Trajan had to retreat in the year 116. He took his wrath out on Jews, massacring Jewish communities in Turkey, in Libya, in Syria, and Egypt, especially, very famously, the Jews of Alexandria. So you'll ask, Ma'in and Shemitah Eitel Har Sinai, the Jews of Babel are fighting against him. Why would he go and kill the Jews of Libya or the Jews of Egypt? And there's the answer. That history would also repeat itself often. Jews, wherever we are perceived as a nation apart. So the Jewish residents of one country will be persecuted because of what Jews do in another country. And that is historically true. The Jews took up arms in Alexandria also and fought back, also inflicting heavy casualties on the Roman forces. And keep in mind, this was not in Babel or Parthia. This was in the Roman Empire. So in the teens, the Jews in certain parts of the Roman Empire were fighting against Romans who had attacked them. But more forces came with tragic results. The Gemara in Sukkah Daf Nun Aleph Amud Beis describes the grand, magnificent shul that existed in Alexandria in Egypt. Very organized. The Gemara says that the shul, the seating was divided by occupation. Made it easy to talk. The goldsmith sat with the goldsmiths, and the silversmiths with the silversmiths, and the stockbrokers sat together. Doctors sat, everybody sat in their own section. And the shul was large enough to accommodate that. It was so large, the Gemara says, that when the Sheikh Sibu were saying Chazar Sashatz, people could not hear in the back. I guess it's true in smaller shuls as well. But people couldn't hear. So when he would finish a bracha, the gabbai, the chazan haknesset, would stand next to him and wave a flag. So people would see in the back he finished the bracha and then answer amen, not having heard the bracha because the shul was too large. The Jews were herded into this magnificent shul. And the Gemara says, Vekuhu katlinhu Alexander Mokdon, all killed by Alexander of Macedonia. Alexander the Great, well, how did he get into the picture? So the Gra emends this. And obviously, for reasons of censorship, they could not record the true story, because the Romans were still in control of them, still dominant when the story was recorded in the Gemara. So they use the name Alexander Mokdon. The Gra emends it. Look in the Gemara, it says on the side, it wasn't Alexander, it was Trachinus, it was Trajan. And Trajan, the emperor, he was the one who had orchestrated the massacre of these communities. Now these battles effectively ended the Jewish communities of Cyprus, and especially Alexandria, which had been the largest Jewish city in the world for at least a century. And again, the Jews in Israel suffered as well. Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon also had to go into hiding. Now Trajan designated his general named Lucius Quietus to lead the rampage, just marauding across the land of Israel, slaughtering as many Jews as they could. Lucius Quietus was a Rosha Merusha, and the protagonist in another famous story in the Talmud, the story of Pappus and Lulianus. Pappus and Lulianus were two brothers, the Gemara records this in Tainus, Safyut Chesem and Beis, two brothers who were executed, the Gemara says, in Lubkiya, which is a city in Syria. Rashi says it was Lod. Whatever. The story was a Roman princess had been found dead, murdered, in the city, and Lucius, the Roman general, Gemara also puts in Trajan's name, but clearly they meant Lucius, the general said that if the murderers did not confess, he would execute every Jew in the entire town. The two brothers came forward and confessed falsely. Pappas and Lulianus just to spare everyone else in the town. So Gemara says, Lucius said to them, if you are descendants of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, remember they were the ones who were thrown into the fire by Nebuchadnezzar and came out alive. So Lucius said, if you are the descendants of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, so then let your God save you. And they answered, Pappas and Lulianus, that they, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they were saved because they were tzaddikim gemurim. And Nebuchadnezzar was a real king. He was a melech hagun. But we are not tzaddikim gemurim, and you are just a rosh hashanah. You are a commoner and an evil person at that. So they were executed. Rashi says there, quoting the Gemara elsewhere, these two, these brothers, Harugei Lod, Ein Kol Birya Yechol Lama B'Mechitzosim B'Gan Eden. No person can stand in their vicinity in Gan Eden. That's how holy they are. They ended their lives by saying to Lucius that you'll pay with your life. And the Gemara says, no sooner were they executed when two officers came from Rome and split his skull, that of Lucius Quietus, and he was killed. What the Gemara is referring to cryptically there is Trajan's end. Trajan retreated, he became ill, and he died right then, in the year 117. When he died, his successor, Hadrian, ordered Lucius Quietus, who basically was a brute and a murderer, ordered him executed because he feared the threat to his own monarchy. So in fact, that's the story the Gemara says. Right after Lucius killed Pappas and Lulianus, they came at that moment, because a new emperor had taken over and killed him as well. In Trajan's wars and persecutions, hundreds of thousands of Jews were murdered across the world. It's the type of persecution we don't really reflect on much because the stories are not well known, but in line with the times, it was typical of Roman rule. Hadrian himself was a very complicated figure. He was a general, he was a patron of the arts. I always enjoy mentioning there's an annual award given out in Europe today for cultural achievement called the Hadrian Award, which always sticks in my craw because he became such a persecutor of Jews. But there are people alive today boasting the winners of the Hadrian Award. Very strange in light of his later reputation. Hadrian was originally a friend of the Jews. In fact, he had befriended one of the Tanoim, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, in Rome. We have very often in the Talmud, Roman emperors will ask questions of Tamid HaChamim, not of course, you know, Titus or Vespasian or Trajan, but others did, the friendlier ones, including Hadrian. So when he was still friendly to the Jews, the Gemara says in Shabbos, Daf Kuf Yotes Lamed Aleph, there he just called the Caesar. He asked Rabbi Yeshua, why is the Shabbos food recho nodeif? Why is its odor so fragrant, Shabbos food? So Rabbi Yeshua said to him, it's because we have a special ingredient we put in the food. It's called Shabbos. So he said, can I have the recipe? And Rabbi Yeshua said, no, it's only effective for a Shomer Shabbos. It's true, Shabbos food tastes different than other food. You'd even have child, you know, Monday night, Tuesday night, sometimes Wednesday night, like me. And it doesn't taste the same as it does on Shabbos. Oh, it's not true. So Hadrian, in fact, his first task, first order of business, was to remove the troops from Bethel, bring them back to Rome. He ended the war. And on that score, at least, the danger to the Jews of Bavel was averted. Now, there are two Hadrians. There was the good Hadrian. In the year 122, he shocked the world, shocked the Jews too, by in writing, granting permission to Jews to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash in the year 122. This would be the first of three times since the Churban that permission was granted to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. The stories related in the Gemara in the Medrash and Brachos Rabbah, Parsha Samech Dalid, in Piskah Yud. He granted permission, did Hadrian, and the Jews started collecting money and rounding up the troops, and people were enthusiastic, and almost immediately the Samaritans complained. We have no concept, by the way, of a good Samaritan. They're all Rishonim, the bad Samaritans. The Samaritans complained, other nations complained, and they told Hadrian that if you let the Jews rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, they will rebel against Rome, and especially they will refuse to pay taxes. Hadrian was in a quandary. In a short time, relatively short time, he revoked the decree and said they could not build the Beis HaMikdash within a few years. The people's instinct was to rebel. Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania stopped them at that point, saying, "Dayenu shenichnasnu l'uma zo b'shalom liyatsanu b'shalom." It's enough that they let us live in peace. If we rebel, we'll lose everything. What Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanani here articulated was what became one very traditional school of thought, and we'll see after the failed revolution of Bar Kokhba, the dominant school of thought in Jewish life, of passivity, national passivity. It gave rise to 1900 years of passivity. In some segments of the Jewish world, the non-Zionist world, that passivity is still the aspiration, not to get involved in any nationalistic yearnings or endeavors, ad bias Mashiach tzidkenu. Not necessarily that it's also, that's one minority fringe sheet though. It's not that it's also, it's just that it's futile. Why should we? We have what we want now. We have enough. We have the Torah. Why do anything more? Rabbi Yeshua convinced them not to rebel. It's enough that he's letting us build yeshivos and spread Torah, fulfill the mitzvos, whereas 30, 40, 50 years ago we couldn't. So Dayenu, it's enough that we have this. Let the Roman lion rest in peace. Well, he was right, at least at first. So Hadrian allowed the Sanhedrin to come out of hiding in the 120s, and they reconvened in Usha, another city in the Galil, in the year 122, and the Sanhedrin flourished. And Jewish life flourished also for a short time. The old guard of the Churban was gone, and there was a new generation that arose. Rabbi Akiva, Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Rabbi Yossi Aglili, Rabbi Eloi. They arose and they took power and they led. And the 120s were a thriving decade for Torah, especially in Usha. The Gemara says a number of times, the Usha Hiskinu. In Usha they had the peace of mind to make takonos that would exist until today, that would define certain aspects of Jewish life. So for example, the Usha Hiskinu, in Usha they ordained the rules of child support. In Usha Hiskinu, the laws of spousal support. Usha Hiskinu, limitations on charitable giving. If a person wants to give tzedakah, al yevazvez yoser mechomesh, you're not allowed to give more than 20% of your earnings to tzedakah, lest you become a public charge. Ve'usha skinu, and Usha, they gave advice on parenting. Again, if you're giving advice on parenting, it means the society is relatively serene. They said you have to have patience with an obstreperous child until the age of 12. Let him be till he's 12. Once he's 12, read him the Riot Act. All these things, Ba'usha Hiskinu. You could tell the tremendous difference in the way Torah was developed in Usha versus the way it was developed Ba'alias Beis Nitza Bilod. The areas that they spoke about were different. The ordinances they made were different. Different, not that the halacha was not the same. It's that they had the peace of mind to deal with areas of halacha that in times of persecution they would not have the opportunity. So these really were the roaring 20s. What followed was calamity. By the late 120s, Hadrian had revoked his promise to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. And even worse, once he turned on Jews, he turned on Jews with a vengeance. He ordered the construction of a new city called Ayla Kapitalina in Yerushalayim, over Yerushalayim, and that a temple to Jupiter be built on Har HaBayis. Now, Hadrian had actually lived in Israel for 2 years during the 20s, and in order to see firsthand the prospects for Roman rule, and to use Israel as a base from which he could visit the Roman holdings elsewhere in the world. living with Jews turned him against Jews. It's hard to imagine such a thing, but it did happen. Living with Jews turned him against Jews, and in short order, Hadrian determined to wipe out the Jewish community in the land of Israel, issuing decrees banning Milah, Shabbos, Mikveh, Talmud Torah. With that, revolt was inevitable, and a dominant, charismatic personality arose to inspire it in the guise of Shimon Bar Kozibo. Shimon Bar Kozibo was nicknamed Bar Kochva by his patron, Rabbi Akiva, who saw his messianic potential, Barach Kochov Mi Yaakov. A star shoots forth from Yaakov, which was Bilam's prophecy of the Mashiach. Bar Kochva organized Jewish forces that had been resisting sporadically into a cohesive fighting force. And they trained, and they trained well. And over time, and the rebellion and all lasted from start to finish, 9 years, in just a few years, Bar Kochva pushed the Roman forces back, that they had to retreat to Caesarea. In the mid to late 20s, perhaps even the year 126, Bar Kochva attacked Yerushalayim, the Roman legion in Yerushalayim, and defeated them, and expelled the legion that was led by Turnus Rufus. To add insult to injury, Rabbi Akiva soon married Turnus Rufus' ex-wife, who converted to Judaism. Bar Kochva in Yerushalayim then, in the late 120s, proclaimed the kingdom of Judea, minted coins. For some reason, I think that's all they did was mint coins. There's so many coins left lying around. He declared himself the Melech, the king, and other things happened as well. Some sources indicate that they began to bring korbanos again, because although the Beis HaMikdash had been destroyed, the Makom HaMizbeach was still known. It was within their historical memory. And for the second time, plans were made to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, and the timing, in fact, was exquisite. It was now about 60 years after the Churban, just like 60 years after the Churban, Ahasuerus was in power and had also given permission to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. He also stopped it, but the plans to build the Beis HaMikdash had started in the 7th decade after the first Churban, so too here as well. People were ecstatic, people were overconfident even. The euphoria lasted 2.5 years. Bar Kochva controlled an area from Lod to En Gedi on a diagonal, including Yerushalayim, including Hebron. In fact, he controlled almost all of what's today Yehudah and most of the Shomron. Not Shechem, but south of Shechem to Yerushalayim and south, even more south of Hebron. This was the first successful revolt against Rome, and so other captive nations became restless, and Rome acted, and they acted vengefully, overwhelming Bar Kochva's army with sheer numbers, and in 130, Bar Kochva had to abandon Yerushalayim, and he headed just a little south to the fortress of Beitar, where he decided to regroup there, and they were fierce fighters, the army of Bar Kochva. The war went on for 3 years, three long years, until Bar Kochva lost his edge, and he lost the support of the Chachamim also in details that the Gemara gives. He began to attribute success to himself and not to God. He in fact wrote God out of the story of the Jews. So in the book of the Maccabees, for example, they record Yehuda HaMaccabees' tefillah. He had a tefillah he would utter before they went into battle, calling on the God of our fathers to aid us in the battles today, etc. Bar Kochva had a different tefillah, the Yerushalmi records. He would say, Ribone de Olmo, lo tisod velo tichsof, Master of the Universe, don't help us, just don't help our enemies either. Meaning it's all me. Let my natural prowess come to the fore and we'll be successful. As happens when people lose their equilibrium, he lost his senses too, he lost his judgment, he killed his uncle, the famous Tanner Abelozah HaModa'i, he killed him when he suspected him of being a traitor for Rome. Eventually, the rabbis denounced him, and he was killed as well. Beitar fell on Tisha B'Av, again the 9th of Av, in the year 133, amid heavy fighting. The losses were astronomical. Yerushalmi in the fourth parak of Tainis says that 800,000 Jews were killed in Beitar alone. And the vivid imagery that the Gemara uses, Gemara says that the blood of the Jews streamed from Beitar as a mountaintop, streamed from there to the sea. Gemara says in Gittin, Daf Nun Zayin Amud Aleph, that Sheva Shanim Batsur Ovde Kachavim Es Karmehen Midamon Shel Yisrael Bilo Zevel. For 7 years, the Romans who were farming the area, they farmed their properties without fertilizer. They just used Jewish blood. That's the extent of the blood. What's interesting is that the Roman casualties were so enormous that they did not celebrate this victory as they did all others. You know, with the parades and the marches and the arches that they built. Titus had an arch. Trajan also has an arch, by the way. The Arch of Trajan, which is in Romania till today. It looks a lot like the Arch of Titus. But nothing. They just reported that they had subdued the revolt. Their losses were too great. There is a working theory, it sounds intriguing, I won't reject it, that the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva, who died during the Omer, actually died fighting at Beitar. That he had led his troops, into his disciples, into battle, and told them that this is a battle for Eretz Yisrael, and they died. Lo nagu kavod zebazeh, whatever the reason was, but in fact, not that they died in a plague. The plague was the arms of Rome. All right, it's a theory. There are a few consequences of the fall of Beitar. Firstly, it was the last Jewish resistance in the land of Israel until modern times. That's how Beitar became a rallying cry. An Irgun-inspired right-wing youth group? I think it still exists today in some form. What's that? It does. And after the fall of Bar Kokhba, the Jews did retreat as a nation into the passive mode of Rabbi Yeshua. Physical resistance became undesirable, even un-Jewish. The notion of taking up arms became un-Jewish, and Jews widely became pacifists. When modern Jews began to fight for the land of Israel, so they had to overcome that pacifist streak. To some extent, it hasn't happened yet, but for others, the ones who wanted to fight, to look back to Bar Kokhba was natural. Secondly, the land itself was renamed Palestine at this point, after the Plishtim, as Hadrian sought to sever, to eradicate any Jewish connection to the land of Israel. So, of course, there were no Plishtim. There were no Plishtim at the time, but nonetheless, he referred back to a biblical name just in order to make the point that there's no Israel, there's no Judea. No Jews, no Judea. And Jews were exiled as well in large numbers. And the Gemara says the Beit HaMikdash itself also was plowed under. I think this is one of the things we commemorate on Shavuos B'Tammuz, was plowed under. So the entire topography of the Har HaBayis changed also to eviscerate Tisha B'Av any Jewish presence. So now the Har HaBayis is a plateau. Remember, it's a har, it's the mountain. That was changed. The ground itself was changed at this point. Thirdly, it's not widely known, but it was at this point that Jewish Christians officially broke with the Jewish people. Why be associated with a bunch of losers who'd lost to Rome? So this really marked the end of an era in which all the bishops were Jews. That's nachas for a parent, of course. All the bishops were Jews. No more. From then on, the recruits to Christianity would be non-Jews, pagans, and within a few decades, certainly within a century, there was very little Jewish influence or numbers in the Christian movement. Finally, the defeat of Bar Kokhba unleashed one of the worst waves of persecution that we have ever endured, likely the worst ever in the land of Israel. For over 5 years, known in the Gemara as the Dor HaShmad, the generation of annihilation. So again, the Gemara quoted before in Sanhedrin of Ayin Dalet Amud Aleph, stating what are the parameters of Kiddush Hashem. So ordinarily, for all mitzvos, averos, it's Yavor Val Yehoreg, except for the carnal three, except the Gemara says, except Bishas Hashmad. during a time of persecution. It's the reference to here, afilu arkos de misano. Even if the non-Jews want you to change a simple minhag, you have to forfeit your life. We have to martyr ourselves in order to say that we will safeguard Torah, even the smaller, almost insignificant aspects of Torah, because that's the only way we will survive. In short, during this time, the last few years of Hadrian, mitzvos were banned, and martyrdom was common, and the performance of mitzvos was a capital crime. And many strange cases that you find in the Gemara that can be attributed to this period of time. So for example, the Gemara asks, I think it's in Erevin, can you wear round tefillin? The Gemara says, you can't, and it's a sakana. So Rashi says, sakana, because someone will come along and bash your head, and the round tefillin will penetrate your skull in a way that the square tefillin wouldn't. Why that would be, it's hard to say. Rav Reuven Margolios has an essay on this and a host of other questions. Hatakeh l'toch habor. Can you blow the shofar in a pit? What are all these things talking about? Mitzvos were banned during this time. It was a capital crime. So Jews searched for ways to fulfill mitzvos and not run afoul of the Roman tyranny. So they asked, can we wear round tefillin? Because the Romans knew tefillin were square. If a person wore a black circular box on his head, it wouldn't be tefillin, it'd be something else. So can you wear it? Because it's not really the mitzvah of tefillin. So the answer was no, and it's still a sakana, because the Romans won't be able to be medayek between square and round. They'll just think that you're violating their edicts. Or at the kelatoch bar, so you can't blow the shofar in a bar because of an echo. Why? You hear the echo, you won't hear the sound. Why would you be takeh betoch a bar? Because you blow the shofar, it can't be heard outside. You'd be heard only inside. You couldn't blow the shofar where the Romans might be able to hear it. All these questions are traceable to this period of time. The death penalty for Milah, for Shabbos, for Talmud Torah, for Lulav, for Tzilin, is a medrash that lists all of these. The Romans said, what did you do? I took Lulav and Esrog. I wore Tzilin. They were all executed following gruesome torture. Reb Chiya says in the Medrash that he could, Reb Chiya lived almost a half century later, he said he could have forfeited his life, he could have forfeited his life, Al Kiddush Hashem, during the Dor Hashmad, but he could not have withstood the torture, which is described in very graphic detail in the Medrash. Then he would have succumbed. Among the victims at this time, what we refer to as the Asara Haruge Malchus, the 10 great Tanoim, whose executions we commemorate every Yom HaKippurim and every Tisha B'Av in the Kinos. So in truth, they weren't killed all in one period, certainly not all in this period of time. Two of them were killed during the Churban, the first two that I mentioned, Rav Gamliel and Rav Shmuel Kohen Gadol. But most were killed during this period of time. So the others over a period of 30, 40 years. In prison, the most famous of the Haruge Malchus, Rabbi Akiva, still smuggled out answers to halachic questions. In prison, before his death, he even decided when the next three leap years would fall, so the calendar would be preserved. Jews went underground, and the entire system was in collapse. And the Jewish people were desperate, as really only happened a few times in our history, because the Romans were able to figure out Klal Yisrael. And they realized there's one way to get rid of the Jews, exterminate the Torah sages. You put an end to Torah, you put an end to the Jewish people. So this was a concerted campaign to destroy Talmid HaChachamim and Talmud Torah. Gemara says in Sanhedrin Daf Yud Gimel Amud Beis, Zechor Oso Ha'ish Latov. Remember this person for good, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava Shmo. His name is Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. He became one of the Asar Haruge Malchus. If not for him, Dine Knossos, if not for him, the whole Masor would have been lost. How so? Well, they banned Smicha. Pamachas Gozer Malchus Harasha Shemad al Yisrael. It's one time, the period we're talking about, the late 130s, when the Romans decreed a Shemad, a war of religious extermination against Jews. Shekol HaSomech Yehareg. Anyone who gives smicha will be executed. Kol nismach yehareg. Anyone who receives smicha, also executed. Ve'ir shesomchem ba, the city in which the smicha took place, techarev, will be destroyed. Utchumen shesomchem bahen, anything within the vicinity, the Shabbos chum, ye'okru, everything will be uprooted. That's intimidation. Masar Yehuda ben Bava, what did he do? Holach v'yashav lo ben shnei harim gedolim. He went and sat between two mountains. He's within the tchum of no city. Uben shtei ayros gedolos, between two large cities. Shnei tchumei Shabbos. Ben usha l'shfaram, in the Galil. V'samach shom chamishos genim. He gave smicha to five elders and saved Torah. Ve'elu hein, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. Those five. The Romans heard, they found Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, they executed him as well, but Torah and the people of Torah were saved through the self-sacrifice of these giants, because these five, they became the leaders of Torah in the next generation. Hadrian died suddenly in the year 39, and right then Chazal saw a bright spot, not only in his death, but they were permitted to bury the Harugei Beitar, the martyrs of Beitar, whose corpses had been left on Beitar for the previous 4 years. They came, and they were astounded by what they saw, and they ordained a bracha. The day was Chamisha Asar Be'av, one of the reasons why we celebrate Tu Be'av, and they ordained a bracha. So the Gemara says in brachos, Taf Mem Tes Lamed Beis, Hatov HaMeitiv V'Yavne Tiknua Keneged Harugei Beitar. The fourth bracha, Birchas HaMazon. The first three, Hazon, and Al Aretz HaMazon, and Yerushalayim, so those were put in, those were the brachos d'oraisa. The fourth is Derabbanan, Hatov HaMeitiv. That was put in a bracha, thanking God who was good and does good because of Harugei Beitar. What happened? Tamar of Masna. Oso Hayom Sheninu Harugei Beitar Likvura. The day they were brought to burial. Tiknu B'Yavna Hatov HaMeitiv. They decreed this bracha. Hatov, God is good. Shelo Hisrichu. They found the bodies had not decomposed, notwithstanding they had laid exposed for 4 years. Tamitiv, and God does good, shenitnu l'kvura, to be able to bring them to Jewish burial. They saw the Yad Hashem in small kindnesses, and it was that perception that sustained them. Never for a moment, no matter what was happening in the Jewish world, or the world generally, did they doubt their status as the Am HaNivchar, as the chosen people. As dark and forbidding as the world looked at times, they always knew that we had survived worse, and we'd survive this as well. Like generations in later times, and for us in recent times as well, they began the phenomenal process of rebuilding Jewish life, even befriending the new emperor, Antoninus Pius, even returning again to Yavne, where they made this bracha. So how do we rebuild? This became the pattern in Jewish history. And what's most important is that you have great leaders. Leaders who would inspire generations with their self-sacrifice. She's just looking at this one period of time. Let's just look for a moment at some of the people we're dealing with. By the war of Bar Kokhba, Rabbi Akiva was well over 100 years old. Rabbi Akiva had lived through the Churban as well. He was born into poverty. The story is well known by all Jews. Descendant of Gerim. He discovered Torah at the age of 40. There are two different stories. One is he fell in love with Rachel, the daughter of Kalba Savua, one of the wealthiest Jews in Jerusalem. He was one of those whose storehouses had been burnt down by the zealots. Rabbi Akiva was one of his shepherds. She said to him, if I marry you, will you go learn Torah? And he said, yes. And her father cut her off, and they lived in poverty for quite a while. The Gemara tells a story that they were sleeping in a manger, and he would pull the straw out of her hair, because they would sleep on straw. They had no mattress, no pillow, no blanket, nothing. He completely cut them off. And he said to her, I promise you someday I will buy for you a Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. Yerushalayim Shel Zahav was a piece of jewelry, a necklace or a brooch that was very common then that the wealthy people wore. Eventually he did. That's one story. He left to study Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. for 12 years, he came back, and we all know the story, of another 12 years, finally returning to his wife with his 24,000 Talmidim. It's another version of the story in the Medrash, the Rabbi Akiva. It could be the stories are both true. They happen at the same time. He saw water falling and eroding a rock. And he said to himself, if water can do that to stone, wear away its resistance, so Torah can do that to an Amoritz like me as well. He went first to learn Aleph Beis with his son, and eventually became a Gadol. His father-in-law reconciled with him, gave him half of his money, and with that he purchased the Rishon Shel Zahav. The Akiva became one of the great halachists, a great poskim, role model as a husband, as a Rebbe, a teacher, a national leader. Every child is reared on the story of his martyrdom. He taught Torah at tremendous personal risk. And finally, the Romans captured him, imprisoned him for teaching Torah, sentenced him to death. He was tortured to death in the Hippodrome in Caesarea in Tishrei of the year 136. Gemara says in Brachos, his flesh was flayed with hot iron combs. And then he said words that we all know in the Gemara in Brachos. His Talmidim saw that he was smiling, and they said, "You'd be smiling, you're being tortured." So he said, "Kol yamai ha'yisi mitzteil posuk zeh. All my days I was troubled by this posuk, v'ahavta Hashem Elokecha b'chol nafshecha. You have to love God, afilu notelus nishmascha. Even if God is taking away your soul, you still have to love Him. Amarti, I would say to myself, Masai Yavoli Yadiva Kaimenu. When am I going to have the opportunity to fulfill the myth of Avas Hashem, even when God is notelus nishmasi? V'achshov shaboli yadi, loa kaimenu. And now that it's come to me to fulfill this, I shouldn't, and I shouldn't rejoice over it. He said the pasuk Shema Yisrael elongated the word Echad as we do, and his soul left him at the word Echad. So he became a standard bearer of Bar Kokhba. It's arguable how much support Bar Kokhba had. Some supported, some didn't. The Rambam says, Dimahu, Rabbi Akiva, the Chochach Meidoro Shumelech HaMashiach. The Rabbi Akiva and all the Chachamim thought he was the Mashiach, Bar Kokhba. Others say not, that it was Bar Kokhba in a minority. In one famous rendition, Rabbi Akiva was told, hair will grow from your palms before Mashiach comes. I guess they didn't like what they saw in Bar Kokhba. Very famous, of course, V'hafnecha kamocha, zek kol gadol b'Torah, and especially for raising the next generation of Tanoim, Rav Meir, Rav Yehuda, Rav Yossi, Rav Elazar, and Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. So Bar Yochai was a disciple of Rabbi Akiva, learned from him even in prison, also tremendous risk, a little different Bar Yochai was. He learned the importance of struggle, and in each realm he struggled. He fled, he had to flee Antoninus Pius for 13 years, hid in the cave with his son, eating just carobs and water for 13 years. But he knew what struggle was, so now it takes on a special poignancy. The Gemara says in Brachos Daf Hey, Reb Shimon Yochai Omer, Shalosh Matanos Tavos Nosan HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeYisrael. God gave Jews three good gifts. The Kulon, Lo Nisanon, Ela Adei Yisurin. All of them were given to us only through suffering. Eluhain, Torah, Eretz Yisrael, Olam Abba. One acquires Torah only through struggle. It can't come easily. One acquires Eretz Yisrael only through suffering, only through struggle. You think there's no price? There's a price. It's not going to be easy. Olam Abba, it's also a struggle. That was his life. So he emerged from the cave, as we could well imagine, a changed person. And he had a very difficult adjustment to the world. He saw people working in the fields. He'd been in such an environment for 13 years, only Torah, carobs, and water. And he said, what are these people doing in the fields? Manichin chai olam, oskim chai shah. They're abandoning eternal life, the life of Torah, and working for food. A lot of people have that idea today, but it's Bar Yochai's idea. So Basco rang out and said, you have to go back to a cave. Go back to the cave for another year to prepare for re-entry into the real world. So spiritually, he and his son were really Yechidei Hador, unique in the generation. He was a Farbrenta. He refused any cooperation with Rome, even after Bar Kokhba. So when others had made their peace with Rome, he still had to go underground. Now the Zohar was attributed to him, that we'll get back to at a later date. He of course is buried in Meron, and his grave is a site of pilgrimage, Ad Hayom. Now there are a couple other unique figures who deserve mention only because they're prototypes. One was Elisha ben Avuya, who was a contemporary of Rabbi Akiva, who went off the derech. In fact, he's the only example of a Talmid Chacham who became a heretic. What's most interesting is that Chazal did not conceal it, because there is that possibility that someone's going to go off the derech. He could not satisfactorily answer questions of theodicy, of Tzadik Viralo, of God's justice, and we're not oblivious to these questions. I think if Chazal had buried his story altogether, which they could have done, I mean, they buried Masada, had they buried it, we would think that people don't have questions, and people live lives without questions, but that would be false. And Chazal took the attitude that questions are questions. They can be good questions. They say in Yiddish that no one ever died from Akasha. Questions are questions, but reality is reality. No matter what happens, God is still the creator and still gave us the Torah and still made us his people, etc. So questions you have to deal with. Nonetheless, we have to deal with Rebbe Avuya as well. How is it possible that someone should go off the derech? So he's a prototype of that. You should beware. Probably the greatest Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim was Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir's notes, we'll see in a few moments, became the essential foundation of the Mishnah, and he was married to Bruria, who was a fiery female on her own, a role model for another reason, the daughter of Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion, one of the Asar Haruya Malchus, who herself was very learned in Torah. Gemara says, the Tanya Tlas Mea Shmaitza V'yoma Mishlash Mea Ravosa. She once learned 300 different halachos in one day from 300 different rabbonim. Meaning she was a sponge for Torah, a Tamidat Chacham, and someone, of course, we would hear from in the future as well as a role model. Now, all this points to the not-so-obvious fact that Jews are never monolithic. It's hard to put every single person into a straitjacket and make everyone paint with the same brush and make them all paint the same color. Now it's black and white. The great Jews are always the ones who are a little different, a little out of the ordinary. That's what makes them special. The one-size-fits-all philosophy that seems common today is really not normal, and it never has been normal. So here's the problem. The danger of nonconformity is Elisha ben Avuya. You may produce an Acher, but the danger of conformity is that you won't produce a Rabbi Akiva, or a Shimon bar Yochai, or a Meir, or a Bruria. So each left a lasting mark on the Jewish people until today, and there are obviously dozens of others that we could reference as well. Something astounding happened in the 40s, stability. Wow. The titular head of the Jewish people is Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Eli, one of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, who was dubbed Rosh Hamidabrim, the chief spokesman of Rome. Now, at first, Antoninus did not revoke Hadrian's decrees. That only happened after Rabbi Shimon led a delegation to Rome, during which he and Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yossi healed the daughter of the emperor and were granted the right to take anything they wanted from the treasury. Gemara tells us, sorry, Me'ilah daf yud zayim at Bez. So they didn't want any money. They had everything open to them. What they did, the Gemara says, Ailinhu leginze lishkol kol debo. They were brought to the treasure house to take whatever they wanted. Ashkecha u'igra shakua v'karua. They took Hadrian's letter, his proclamation of decrees, and tore them up. And stability ensued, and the Jews were treated fairly. Rome in the 40s even invested in the land of Israel, building roads and bridges and markets, which Rabbi Yehuda appreciated. Said they're doing it, you know, because they want to help us. And that was when Bar Yochai said, no, they do it because they want the markets for the zonos and the bridges for tolls. That's why we build roads in New Jersey, by the way, for tolls. He wasn't wrong. But he said that, and he was informed upon, that's why he went into hiding. The Sanhedrin was briefly reestablished in Yavne in the late 50s, and it soon returned to Ush as well. The Nisias, though, did not yet resume its prominence, owing to the long periods of time in hiding. This led to a very interesting story, somewhat mysterious. The Gemara relates in Harios, Dr. Gimon Bez, a rivalry ensued between Rabbanim. It's hard to imagine. But you had the Nasi, Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel, now come out of hiding to head the Sanhedrin, but Rabbanim came from Bavel. Rabbi Nasan was a great Talmud Chacham, came from Bavel. Rabbi Meir had fled. He came back because Torah was thriving in Bavel, which again was not under Roman rule. So the Rabbanim in Bavel wanted to assume greater authority, right, and that what happened was, in the Beis Medrash, they stand up when Rabbi Shimon walked in, and when Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Nosson walked in, they stood up as well, and that bothered Rabbi Shimon because he thought it was an insult to the Nisius. So it bothered Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Nosson also. They determined the next time that he would come and give a shiur, they would ask him questions from Uktzin, the last Masecht in Shas, which nobody ever studies except if you're doing Mishnayos. Yomi, the very last Masechta, deals with the Tumah Tahara of pots, potted plants. Rabbi Shimon was warned about it. They boned up on his Uktzin, and that day they peppered him with questions, and he rattled them off, and he exposed them, and he kicked them out of his yeshiva. Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Nosson, the atmosphere was very tense, and there was never really a reconciliation. They just died, went their own ways. The truth is that power abhors a vacuum, and Torah had filled it when the political class went underground. So Rabban Shimon, the Talmud Chacham too, but he was perceived as the political leader and not as a spiritual leader by Rabbi Meir and others, and that's where the problems came in. When Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, who was Antoninus' pious son-in-law, took power in 161, he reached out to Jews as Parthia had attacked the eastern regions of the Roman Empire, and Marcus Aurelius did the opposite of Trajan. Rather than clamp a heavy hand on the Jews, Marcus Aurelius reached out to them to use them as a base of support for his wars. Shortly thereafter, the Nasi died, Rabbi Shimon, and was succeeded by his son, the great Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, who is a person of exquisite moral caliber and intellectual excellence. Gemara says, from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, we never saw Torah u'gedula b'makom echad, Torah and political greatness in one place, as was with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Interestingly, the Gemara says on the Pasuk, the Medrash in Koheles Rabbah, the Zorach HaShemesh uva HaShemesh, the sun rises and the sun sets. The day Rabbi Akiva was killed, in 136, that was the day Rabbi HaNasi was born. There's really no gap at all in the Masorah. Marcus Aurelius Antoninus befriended Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and vice versa. They were kindred spirits. Their friendship, their alliance, produced lasting results, as we'll see. Chazal perceived this as the ideal relationship of Yaakov and Esav, partners who could benefit each other and the world. So Rebbe took advantage of the relative stability, established his yeshiva in Beit Sharim, also in the Galil. Torah again flourished. Israel was peaceful and prosperous. The next three decades of probably the golden era of Israel under Roman rule, without any need or desire for independence. Now, Antoninus himself asked questions. He was a philosopher, wrote a book of philosophy that's extant called Meditations, and he was civilized, which was also unusual for the time. Non-Jews referred to him as Marcus Aurelius. The Gemara refers to him as Antoninus. The physician, the famous physician Galen, lived then, and he began the systematic study of medicine. In fact, there was a devastating plague that afflicted the Roman Empire in the 160s that Galen was able to point out the source of, and because of that, and because of Marcus Aurelius' own character, they didn't seek out a scapegoat, as was common in the ancient world. They attributed to medical causes. In return, Rebbe supported him in his wars. He gained support, and in that environment produced a remarkable work, the Mishnah. So there are two different approaches to how the Mishnah came about. One the one accepted by most is recorded in the Igeres of Shreira Gaon, who is the head of the Gaonate in Bavel in the 10th century. We'll get them later. He writes, "V'shoto hachomim b'yomo sh'Rebbe mikol shmag." In Rebbe's days, the land was quiet of any persecution. Mishum ha'alva sh'ahisa ben Antoninus l'Rebbe, because of the love between the two leaders. V'hiskim Rebbe l'sader alocha g'deshi gosim rabbeinu kulam pe'achad loshen echad. Rebbe decided to record all the teachings of the Chachamim of prior centuries so that they'd all speak the same language, they have the same text, and not that each one should teach Allah in a different way, because early generations didn't need it. Hoil v'tar shabal pehi, since the Torah is really meant to be oral, so things were not recorded in addition to the Torah shabiksav, the written Torah. But now it changed. So that's the question. How is the oral law recorded when it's supposed to be oral? If it's recorded, and this was the hesitation, by definition it becomes limited. People start arguing over the texts and not arguing over the ideas. On the other hand, without any text at all, the arguments can be endless. So this was a departure from Mesorah. Everybody recognizes that. But with great prescience, Rebbe felt that he had no choice. Eis lasas Lashem, eifera tarasecha. It's time to act for God when the Torah is in danger of being nullified. That is to say, it's better to violate the particular of the system in order to save the system in toto, especially when otherwise the whole system would be lost. So Rebbe saw there was an attrition of population in the land of Israel. He would die, so would Antoninus. Antoninus died in 180. Who's going to be the next emperor? Things were never stable from transition to transition. So of course, one had to be Rebbe, the dominant, powerful, towering figure, to pull this off. The Smag maintains that the prohibition against recording the oral law only applied so long as the non-Jews did not accept the Bible. So once they accepted the Bible, as the Christians had done half a century earlier, then the prohibition was no longer in force. And then the uniqueness of our Torah is in the Torah Shebal Peh, as the Gemara says in Gittin, Daf Samech Amud Beis, Rabbi Yochanan said, Lo karas HaKadosh Baruch Hu brisim Yisrael, Ela b'shvil dvarim Shebal Peh. The whole covenant that God has with us is based on the oral Torah, not on the written Torah. Shenemar, the Pasuk says, Ki al pi hadvar mo'ele. Through these verbal words, Karati Itcha Bris Ves Yisrael. It's through the Torah Shebal Peh, which is our uniqueness, and not Torah Shebichsav. Other nations have also by now accepted Torah Shebichsav. So the Rambam says Rebbe wrote the Mishnah. Most hold that Rebbe did not. Rather, he's described as the editor of the Mishnah. That is to say, the Torah Shebal Peh had been memorized since the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, in a very formal way. The Talmud refers to as Mishnah Rishona. So it was known. These specific citations were known. But variants developed, especially as individuals kept notebooks of these discussions. Rebbe took the notebooks and scattered writings of prior generations, especially the notebooks of Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Meir, divided the wide expanse of Torah into 63 categories called Mesechtos, tractates. I never heard the word tractate used in any other context but the Talmud, an English word though. And these tractates were themselves grouped into six siddurim, six orders, shisha siddurim, shas, zroim, which deals with brachos and agricultural laws, Moed, Shabbos and Yom Tov, Noshim, women's laws, and marriage, etc., Nezikin, Torts, Kadoshim, and Taros, dealt with the Karbonos and the laws of Tumah Tahara. Originally, there were only 60. The Bavas were one. Kama Metziah Basa, really one Bava, called Maseches Nezikin. Sanhedrin Makos were also one, but later on, I guess the publishers did that, they made it to 63. Some hold Rebbe Akiva made that original order, not Rebbe, but yet it's attributed to Rebbe. Everyone holds Rebbe put the mission in its final form. The Rambam says it was published in his lifetime. According to Rashi, Smag, and others, it was actually only published in the 3rd century after his death, but Rebbe put it in its final form, organized, ready for rote memorization. Hence, we'll find acrostics in the Gemara very frequently. Simon, this word followed by 5 words, that combine mean nothing, but yet are a signal to what is coming up. Now, of course, this is a magnificent historic achievement. For the first time, Jews scattered about the world could study the same text, not that of Tanakh, but of the Torah Shebaal Peh, and maintain the same intellectual focus. Now, for the first time, the depth of Torah transcended geographical limitations and became our companion in the absence of a geographical center point, which is really the key. By the end of the century, the Torah was the focus of Jewish life and no longer the land of Israel. It was the common denominator of Jews and no longer the land of Israel. And there was something else here. For the first time, you had in writing a comprehensive guide to daily conduct that included also areas of observance like Kushan and Tyros that had mostly lapsed, but because they're in the Shas, whose rebirth could be anticipated. The mission was completed in the year 188 of the Common Era. Note the symbolism. It's exactly 1,500 years after Maimon Har Sinai and exactly 500 years after prophecy ended. Now there's a new means of relating to Kadosh Baruch Hu through the Mishnah, through Torah Shebaal Peh in writing. As Jews began leaving Israel for Bavel and elsewhere in the exile, this was caused by fear of the uncertain, despite the stability of the moment. In light of the caprice of the Roman emperors, you never knew what was coming. The Torah, rather than the land, became the unifying element of Jewish life, and that remained the norm for 18 centuries. Rebbe himself died around the year 200. Just to summarize, from its dire beginnings this century, with the reign of terror of Trajan and the flight of the Sanhedrin several times and the failed rebellion of Bar Kokhba and the utter dissolution of Jewish national life in the land of Israel, the second century ended with the golden age of Jewish life under Roman rule, with promise and hope, with the tools in place, the Mishnah and the academies that would teach it and expound it, those tools that would ensure Jewish survival through a very long exile. I thank you all very much. Next week, we're off. I'll be doing some research in the field, and we'll resume in 2 weeks with the third century.